Eku iluna all rise. Ke noho nei ka aha ho'okolokolo ho'opi'iku e o kaluna kanawai hanohano o Catherine G. Leonard a me kaluna kanawai hanohano o Karen T. Nakasone a me kaluna kanawai hanohano o Sonia M.P. McCullen e ho'omalu nei. The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Catherine G. Leonard, Karen T. Nakasone, and Sonia M.P. McCullen presiding. E noho ilalo, please be seated. Case number CAAP-21-0024, For Our Rights, a Hawaii Corporation, Diana Loma, David R. Hammond, Randy Hammond, Janet Eisenbach, Lavana Loma, Kate Paika, Lawrence K. Pell, Geraldine Shokine, Leonard Shokine, Daniel Hashimoto, Christina Cole, Francesca Woger, Naya Lindsay, Michael Mazzone, Lynette J. Harley, and Lorraine L. Patch, plaintiffs appellants versus David Y. Ige in his official capacity as governor of the state of Hawaii, Claire E. Connors in her official capacity as attorney general for the state of Hawaii and state of Hawaii dependent appellees, Mark Victor for appellant, Nicholas McLean for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Good morning. Counsel, would you like to make your appearance?
I would. Thank you, Judge. Mark Victor, on behalf of the appellants who are also the plaintiffs in the case down below, I want to also wish you a happy Wednesday and also say good morning to opposing counsel and everyone else in attendance. I'm with the Attorneys for Freedom Law Firm, and we are in Bishop Square, just a few minutes walk from here. Would you like me to start my argument now?
Not just yet.
Okay.
Good morning. Would appellee like to make an appearance?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Nick McLean for the state appellees. I'm a deputy attorney general in the Department of the Attorney General, and with me at council table is the Solicitor General, Kim Guidry.
Good morning. This is the first in-person oral argument held by the Hawaii Appellate Court since before the first emergency proclamation in March 2020. And it's really nice to see you all here this morning. We appreciate you coming here, and we appreciate your compliance with the Chief Justice's COVID-related orders, especially with respect to the wearing of masks throughout this hearing. Now, if you look at me, you'll see my glasses are steaming up, and I don't like the mask any better than anybody else in this room. I'm quite sure of that. But I really would appreciate your compliance with that. Normally, attorneys would stand at the podium to make their arguments, but that was going to require various additional COVID protocols. So, counsel, you will argue seated at the tables where you are, where you each have your own microphone. We'd like you to remain seated if you would. That way you can look at your notes or whatever if you like. And in addition, with you seated at the tables, we were able to remove some giant plexiglass barriers that would have otherwise been between you and the court. So, Mr. Victor, I understand you have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's right, Judge. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Members of the panel, and by the way, I appreciate the court's comments, and I'm honored to be here for the first oral argument. Members of the panel, this is really a case about what I would say the fundamental tenets of a free society. It's about our legal philosophy, what I would call our bedrock, most fundamental principles. We here in Hawaii, as well as in the United States generally, we seek to avoid concentrations of governmental power. The reason for that is because fundamentally, we're skeptical about government power. We believe in the separation of powers. The reason we believe in them, and I'll quote that oft-quoted mention from Lord Acton, we believe power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's why our government is of limited and delegated powers. We reject the idea that government has all the power unless they're specifically limited. Now, we had a case. There's one case that's mentioned in both briefs that I believe is actually on all fours with this case. It's the Wisconsin case. It's in both of our briefs, and I'm sure you've looked at it. But I do want to give you a very short quote from that case. I think it's very applicable here. It says, and I'm quoting from the Fabric case, "Our constitutional structure does not contemplate unilateral rule by executive decree. It consists of policy choices enacted into law by the legislature and carried out by the executive branch. Therefore, if the governor has authority to exercise certain expanded powers not provided for in our Constitution, it must be because the legislature has enacted a law that passes constitutional muster and gives the governor that authority." And as I've said,
sorry to interrupt you, but can you confirm that you did not seek relief with respect to the initial March 4th, 2020 proclamation? In other words, you don't challenge the governor's authority on the first one. Is that correct?
It's clear under the statute that the governor has the emergency power, assuming that statute is constitutional in the first place. Absolutely, he has the power to enact the powers that are specifically delegated to him in that emergency declaration. So yeah, we don't challenge that.
Okay, so, and you just said an interesting thing, which leads to another question, which is, does the complaint as currently drafted allege a constitutional challenge to any part of Chapter 127A?
It would only be if, I think this court should only reach that question, if, and this is the same exact thing that happened in that Fabric case in Wisconsin, this case could be completely resolved without the constitutional question. You only reach that question if you adopt what appellees believe is the construction of that statute. We think, and I'm going to go through that statute, we think the statute's very clear on its face. But if you adopt their construction, which essentially would allow the governor to continually declare another state of emergency on essentially the same facts, then, and only then, we would argue it's a unconstitutional delegation given to the governor. But it's only if you find appellee's construction is the appropriate construction.
Okay, so just, this is our only chance to chat, so explain that to me. Why, if we adopt appellee's interpretation of 127A14, why does it become unconstitutional?
Well, it becomes unconstitutional because what we have essentially is what we have now, which is one person, the governor, the executive branch, exercising for an indefinite length of time until the governor decides it's appropriate to relinquish those powers, all of the powers that are delegated, which are very broad and sweeping powers, very broad and sweeping powers. If he can exercise that kind of authority for an indefinite period of time, what that essentially means is the legislature doesn't have to legislate. They are delegating far too much power to the executive for an infinite period of time.
Okay, so what we're here today on is an appeal from a dismissal order.
That's right.
Okay, on a complaint that has two counts. I don't see a constitutional challenge of that nature in the complaint, Mr. Victor. Can you point me to it?
I can't specifically point you to that. That you're absolutely correct about that. But nonetheless, this court can rule sua sponte on a constitutional issue if, in fact, the court finds that there is an unconstitutional delegation here. But as I've said, the thrust of my comments today are not going to be on that issue. The thrust of my comments are going to be simply focused on the statute. The statute is clear. And in fact, unless the court has other questions, I'm going to get to that very quickly. And so HRS 127A, that's the statute really we're talking about here. And there could be two aspects of this, as we've just discussed. The one we're focusing on is the governor exceeded that delegation. And that goes exactly with what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said. Doesn't say in the Constitution the governor can do this, only in that statute. So I'd like to focus on that. 127A, the emergency powers here, frankly, to me, makes perfect sense. I don't challenge the statute as written because emergencies occur. We know this in Hawaii sometimes, unfortunately, better than other states. Emergencies are going to happen. And it's just a fact of life that the legislature may not be able to convene a special session quickly enough to deal with that emergency. Things need to be done immediately. This is why it makes sense to allow the governor in that statute to unilaterally decide what's an emergency, because there's no time to debate this question. But of course, we should recognize here, and I think the legislature did, that there's serious potential for abuse, even on this point right here. What's an emergency? This is...
Okay, but you didn't challenge the emergency here, Mr. Victor. You challenged the procedure. So I think it would be helpful to the court if we, you know, focused on that part of it.
I'm only getting into that, Judge, because I think that the underlying purpose of the statute, of what the we're trying to get to, what's the legislative intent here. And I think it's important to understand why they limited this to 60 days. And part of the reason why is because there's lots of potential for abuse here. As I've said, what's an emergency? This could be virtually anything. I mean, I could imagine we could have an economic crisis that maybe a governor could say this is an emergency, a big storm. How big does a storm have to be? How bad does a flood have to be? Could a governor declare an emergency because there are questions about maybe legitimacy of an election or something like that? There are infinite possibilities, but we can't have debate on this point. This is part of the reason why the legislature circumscribed that power so tightly. Also, what laws are necessary? There's no time for legislature to get together and figure out what laws are actually needed here. There's lots of potential for abuse. Actually enforcing those laws, those are the typical duties of the executive. In non-emergency times, this is a big concern. This is exactly why we have separation of powers, because we don't trust any executive to completely execute the laws without being checked. So there's potential for abuse there, but in an emergency, we acknowledge those risks. The only limit we have, reasonably, is how long it lasts. That's the only way to limit this. And that's what we're challenging.
Mr. Victor, doesn't the chapter 127A itself have a mechanism for seeking relief? I think I'm talking specifically about 127A27, which is a procedure for injunctive relief.
It does. And that,
okay, so there is a check by the court system that is contemplated in the statutory scheme.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And that's part of why we're here today. And if we were going to raise the lack of a private right of action, that's exactly the section I would have focused the court to. But there's no check other than us bringing a lawsuit in this statute. And the legislature doesn't presumably pass a law with the idea in mind that the way to check the governor is some citizens need to get together, spend some money on a lawyer, and bring a court action that comes almost 2 years after the governor's declared his first proclamation. I'm simply saying in the statute itself, there's not a check there. But I think, and I'm going to invite you, you probably have already done this, to really carefully look at the wording of the statute. I think that this case could be entirely resolved simply by going carefully through that statute. And I'd like to take you through at least my thought process of how to interpret that statute. And I'm going to read it here very briefly, specifically the one at issue here, which is HRS 127A-14 subsection D. I think that's really the focus of our inquiry. I'm going to delete the sections about the local mayoral because that's not at issue here. But if I read that, very simply, a state of emergency shall terminate automatically 60 days after the issuance of a proclamation of a state of emergency or by separate proclamation of the governor, whichever occurs first. Now, there's three parts of this that I think each of the three go to give us a window to what the legislature was thinking when they passed this section.
So, Mr. Victor, pretty sure we've all read that numerous times. I know I have, and I agree with you. It says it terminates at 60 days, but what it doesn't say is that he can't issue another proclamation.
There's no, I completely agree with you here. I certainly concede that point.
Is there anything in the legislative history that you are able to glean that indicates that the governor is limited to a single proclamation?
We don't have any guidance on that point. This case will provide that guidance for future states of emergency, which I think that this is why this case is so important. But I think if we go through that language, and certainly I concede that there's nothing that says the governor can't do it, but there's also nothing that says the governor can do it. And so that's really the root of this. What's the default setting? Does the governor get to do anything that he's not specifically prohibited from doing? Or does he only get to do the things that he's specifically granted authority to do? And I would suggest our entire government is set up with this idea of limited powers in mind. The shall terminate automatically seems very clear. It doesn't say...
Well, let me just back you up to the part A of that same statute, which, and I'm sure you've looked at it too, Mr. Victor. It says the governor may declare the existence of a state of emergency in the state by proclamation if the governor finds XYZ, a lot of which are defined terms. I know you've looked at that because you're not challenging the first proclamation, but it does seem to say the governor can issue a proclamation if he finds certain circumstances exist.
No question about that, Judge. I think that's absolutely true. What it doesn't say is he can't continue to issue a state of emergency, to reissue a state of emergency based on the same, or I would argue, substantially similar facts. It doesn't say that at all. It would overthrow the entire meaning of the statute. I think, you know, it doesn't say shall terminate automatically unless. Other states say that. There are several of these cases where the governors, the appellees, have actually cited those cases. In those cases, the statutes say those types of things. Ours doesn't. It doesn't say the proclamation may terminate in 60 days. The legislature opted for shall instead of may. They could have certainly delegated power like other states did until they acted. Other states did that. Hawaii didn't do that. They could have delegated until the governor relinquished power. Other states did that too. This legislature didn't do that. Our task isn't to determine the wisdom or lack thereof of what the legislature did or didn't do, or even what the governor did or didn't do. Our task is just—
How do you propose that the court construe the or clause then? It says, or by a separate proclamation of the governor or mayor, whichever occurs first.
I think this is an excellent observation. Thank you for that question. It definitely contemplates a second proclamation, but only for the purpose of terminating the first proclamation sooner. I know appellees certainly argued, yes, there's a on page 9 of their brief, actually, they said, yes, it does have this other or. And I think it's very interesting because this language, whichever occurs first, is put in there. If they delete that language, imagine we just delete that language, whichever occurs first. In other words, it terminates in 60 days unless the governor issues another proclamation. That's the reading appellees want you to adopt. They want you to read out of the statute those last three words. But those last three words are there for a reason. They also could have said, and this would have changed it as well, whichever occurs later or last. Presumably they were aware that they could have drafted it that way. Had they said that, we wouldn't be here, because that contemplates that the governor can actually issue another proclamation that extends the first proclamation. They didn't do that. I also think the word a in there is very important. He gets to issue a proclamation. It doesn't say any proclamation. If it said any proclamation, we wouldn't be here on that either. That gives me a signal. It gives us a signal that the legislature is thinking that it's possible that the governor could actually proclaim another state of emergency based on the same facts. So I think we do need to read it very, very carefully, because what we're talking about here is a grant of substantial power here. This isn't just a small grant of power. Now, admittedly, it's necessary Everybody, I'm not contesting that. Our side is not contesting. Emergencies happen. We need to have this section. The only question is, does it need to go on past 60 days? Some places it does, because in other places, the legislature has no ability to reconvene. In those situations, maybe it makes sense. But here in Hawaii, we have a legislature that can call a special session. So if we look at the underlying thought process involved, why would the legislature pass this and use such clear language? Because as the appellees argue, yes, the emergency could go on for a long time. They speak as if it's an absurd result, I think is the language that they use, by saying, well, the emergency could of course go past 60 days. They give us a parade of horribles, what things that could happen. Of course that could happen. This doesn't foil our reading of the statute. All it means is 60 days is contemplated for the legislature to simply get together, and they can do anything they want at that time. And maybe they would have. Maybe they would have gotten together and said, you know what? This is Corona thing is a really serious emergency. We're going to extend the power of the governor.
Mr. Victor, you brought up that they can call special sessions, right? So they did 5 times in the last 2 years, and they've had a regular session, and they didn't address this 60 days or make any amendment to curtail these proclamations. Is that tacit approval?
I would say no. I would say our task isn't to determine what the statute means in the context of what the legislature has done in the past, or even what it's doing now. I understand there are bills pending right now to terminate the governor's authority, but I don't follow them, and neither should this court, unless and until they actually become law. Politicians do things for re-election purposes and other purposes all the time. To have this court interpret a statute based on...
Sorry, GM, I think it's GM 11, is it 1157 maybe, did become law. And that actually refers to the proclamation that the governor had issued. And so it's the eviction moratorium.
I see. Yes. Right?
And so it refers to the proclamation. Isn't that tacit approval?
I would say no, it's not tacit approval. This is one aspect of one part of the authority that the governor exercised. This has nothing to do with the fundamental power of the government, of the governor, to continually exercise power. So I think to take a look at what the legislature did and glean from that what the understanding of a different legislature at a different time, what they actually wrote, even if they wrote something different or something was pending today, completely contrary to what they actually wrote, our task is to focus on what the law is right now. And the law right now, or the governor's authority right now, is still based on this very section, which has not been altered. The actual section itself has not been altered by the governor. So I would say no, there are many things going on out in the political world that are not the jurisdiction of this court. I think our focus should be limited simply to what does this law mean that's on the books right now? And the net effect of the law, as we know, is we now have a governor. And again, I want to be clear about this. I certainly don't mean to say that I think the governor has done anything in bad faith here. Our argument does not depend at all on anybody acting in bad faith here. In fact, we could even take as a given that everybody is acting in good faith here. Maybe the governor has done exactly what I would do if I was governor. That's not the point. The point is there's going to be another governor down the road. There'll be other states of emergencies down the road. I remember having a discussion with a U.S. attorney one time about the Patriot Act. And his said, well, we would never misuse that. We have good people here in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, as it turned out, we got different people who have done different things over the years. The same is true here. So the issue isn't the wisdom of what the legislature is doing now or the wisdom of what the governor is doing now. The issue is, what does this say? This huge grant of power, which I think if we read very carefully, as I very quickly went through, I think the letter A gives us some guidance. They didn't say any proclamation, they said a proclamation. And I think this whichever occurs first language, if we really think about and contemplate, I'm sorry, I could barely see with the glasses steaming up, and I apologize for that. I think this language, whichever occurs first, is absolutely telling. I think if we just focused on that and even forgot about everything else, if they just didn't use that language, I would agree with the appellee's construction. If they used later, no problem, but they used first. And I think if we think about that language, it tells us everything we need to know about what that statute means. And also, this Latin phrase, which I'm going to apologize in advance that I'm going to completely butcher here, expressio unius est exclusion ulterioris. As we know, this is a basic rule of statutory construction. They said one thing. We can infer they didn't mean the other things that they didn't say. First means first. It doesn't mean last. A means A, not any. Shall terminate after 60 days means shall terminate, not may terminate. I don't know how they could have written this any more clear than they did. I also ask you to think about how dangerous a point it would be if we just simply said, well, it doesn't say he can't do it, therefore he can do it. I mean, just as sort of a thought experiment, what if the governor just simply said, look, it doesn't say I can't assume full control of the courts as well. In fact, if you look at the statute, there's probably a stronger argument here for that. I look at 127A12, which discusses his powers, and I look at section B5, specifically allows the governor to seize control of all public buildings, including this building right here. And it says he may, not he shall, he may make alternative provisions as he deems advisable. I see nothing.
So Mr. Victor, I appreciate that. But let me segue into another question because your time is growing short here. If we were to reject your claim based on the statutory interpretation, what about the circuit court's ruling on your second count? The court said, quote, plaintiff's claim in regards to the vagueness of prior emergency proclamations, which are no longer in effect, is deemed moot and is dismissed with prejudice. Now, you raised some arguments about exceptions to the mootness doctrine. What happens if we were to vacate the court's ruling on that second claim as on mootness grounds? As to that second cause of action, assuming we rejected your statutory interpretation?
Well, certainly the court can do whatever it wants here. And I think the issues are of grave constitutional significance. I think the strongest arguments are based on simply the statute. It means what it says, and we shouldn't get past that. If you do get past that and accept that the governor can do virtually anything that he's not specifically prohibited from doing, which I think is a very scary proposition, frankly, then I think we could certainly find that this is an unlawful delegation and not have to go any further because so much power. I mean, I think it's obvious.
So are you abandoning your second cause of action?
No, I'm simply saying we shouldn't reach it. If we do get past the unlawful delegation, there's all kinds of issues here that it's very difficult to interpret. I think questions about where you have to wear a mask and don't have to. There's endless issues here that haven't been ferreted out. People have been cited for wearing masks on the beach. It's not clear how far they can be. It's not clear on many, many issues. So yes, there's an endless possibility of vagueness, but I sure hope the court doesn't get us there, because to get there is to necessarily say initially that the governor can keep doing this until, as the other side says, they say, look, essentially trust us. At some point, the governor will decide the time is right and he will relinquish power. That's not the way a free society works. And so I would simply say, yes, the court could get there. Yes, the court could make that argument. I certainly hope the court won't even get to the unlawful delegation, because I don't know what the legislature could have done short of saying we really mean it, or short of saying very clearly, the governor can't declare another state of emergency on exactly the same facts. But if I was in the legislature having this discussion, I would say, why would we have to say that? We've already said it shall terminate 60 days, there's nothing, there's no possibility of it going past unless he issues another proclamation, which can only terminate it sooner.
So Mr. Victor, as I understand it, the circuit court did not reach the unlawful delegation question. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as well.
Okay. So do you think that that is even before us, or just the court's ruling on the statutory interpretation?
Well, I think that certainly if you find that that issue is not moot and you get past the other issues, you could make a ruling on the merits of that issue. And I think it should not be moot, because obviously this entire matter, and I know mootness was raised by appellees, but if there was ever an issue that evades review, it's this issue, because there's only 60 days here. I look how long it's taken us to get to this point. So I see my time is up, and I want to make sure I can reserve at least 5 minutes. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Victor. Mr. McClain, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to begin by thanking the court for the opportunity to address these important issues today. Emergencies, by their nature, are unpredictable, but one common thread in all emergencies is that a flexible and adaptable legal framework is crucial to enable government to respond to changing circumstances and protect the public. Now, the legal framework the legislature established in Chapter 127A recognizes this important fact. We've heard a lot this morning from opposing counsel about the need to conform to and to honor the legislative framework that the legislature created. And to be clear, we absolutely agree with that. In issuing emergency proclamations to address the COVID-19 pandemic, the governor has been faithfully applying and working within the legal framework that the legislature created. With the court's permission, I'd like to begin by discussing that framework, which is found in Chapter 127A. As I'll explain, we believe the text, purpose, and the case law all counsel in favor of our reading of the statute. I'll then plan to address appellant's constitutional challenge, but I think just briefly, I think Your Honor was exactly right that this claim was not alleged in the operative complaint, and so it's our position that it is not properly before the court. But if Your Honor wants to discuss the merits, I can certainly do that. And then I'll also underscore that the challenge on the statutory question fails for a number of reasons, not only on the merits, but also because of the lack of a private right of action. And then finally, I can address some of the justiciability issues that we raised in our brief. And of course, I welcome the court's questions. So I think everyone agrees that in terms of the text of Chapter 127A, the key provision is Section 127A-14, and I think it's absolutely right that you really have to read Subsection D in connection with Subsection A, which in our view provides a very clear delegation to the governor of the authority to declare a state of emergency. And you know, we heard a lot about the letter A and how that is a sort of is a significant difference here, and it's, and I don't really follow that argument, to be honest, because we're talking about a state of emergency, and so it's our position that each proclamation creates a separate state of emergency, and so okay, each
so
time.
Let me interrupt just briefly. So you agree that at 60 days that proclamation is done.
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And so we agree that, to some extent, people have been sort of using the term either in the media or elsewhere about extending an emergency proclamation. And so it's our position that legally that's not correct. That what happens each time there's an emergency proclamation is there's a separate standalone determination by the governor that a state of emergency exists based on the facts as they exist at the time the proclamation is made. And that this actually plays a really important role because it forces government to deliberate and to determine whether the circumstances continue to warrant these extraordinary powers. And we agree that a state of emergency is not the ordinary course, and it is everyone's intention.
So how does it end, Mr. McClain? Can a governor just go on and on and on and on forever declaring emergencies?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think there are a couple of answers to that. I think the first answer is found in the text of the statute itself. You know, there's a definition of what an emergency is that appears in 127A 2-2, I believe. And so, you know, an emergency isn't just anything that the state wants. An emergency is defined as an occurrence or imminent threat thereof, which results or may likely result in substantial injury or harm to the population.
But what is the mechanism? Because the statute does have some very strong language, which has not been challenged in this litigation to date, about the governor being the sole judge of the emergency.
Well, I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think it's important to read that language in context. So the way I interpret that language would mean there's a presumption that the governor will be the one to make that determination. But, you know, we acknowledge that all government action, whether it's a statute or executive action, certainly has to comply with the federal constitution, for example. So if you got to a point where an emergency proclamation, given the circumstances that exist, wasn't supported by a rational basis, that, for example, would be a federal constitutional limitation. And we would embrace that reading. We agree that that is potentially a valid type of claim that could be brought either in state or federal court.
But your position is that, and I'm not sure Mr. Victor would disagree, that there has been no allegation in this case that there's no rational basis for the supplemental proclamations.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I completely agree with that. And I think it's important to really underscore that this is, on the statutory issue, a very narrow claim. I mean, there are some very broad separation of powers issues that don't appear in the operative complaint, but the statutory claim is narrow. It doesn't allege, for example, a bad faith use of this or an abuse of power in that sense. It doesn't allege the factual basis doesn't support the emergency proclamation. And so I think that's important when we think about, well, what are mechanisms for potential enforcement here? Absolutely. And I think with respect to Chapter 127A, you know, we've talked a little bit about the text, and I think the real, you know, the key point here is that it's the appellants who want to rewrite the statute. They want to add an additional subsection that says no more than one state of emergency may be issued for any underlying emergency, and that's simply not the statute that the legislature wrote. And, you know, we spoke a little bit earlier, or the court spoke earlier about the role of legislative intent and purpose. And I think it's important here to sort of bear in mind that the legislature itself told us what its purposes were in passing in 2014 this statute, the framework that appears in 127A. So in 127A-1, the statute specifically said that its intent and purpose was, quote, to provide for and confer comprehensive powers to the governor. The legislature also said in that same.
But section, Mr. McLean, I don't think he's challenging the governor's powers. It's more of the governor has that power for 60 days. So I don't think that, I mean, I agree with you on your reading, but I don't think that's the issue. It's the 60 days.
Understood, Your Honor. But I think that it's important to read that 60-day language in light of its purpose. So the legislature tells us that, you know, for example, in 127A-1, that it was passing the statute to address the possibility of the occurrence of disasters or emergencies of unprecedented size and destructiveness. So the legislature told us that they were really concerned about major disasters. And so it's our position that it would be paradoxical to say that although the legislature was concerned about really big disasters, you know, potential disasters that could last for potentially a long time, that it also wanted to put in a drop dead date of 60 days that would radically change the scope of emergency powers in the state. And, you know, we've reviewed the legislative history and we certainly can't find anything that suggested that the legislature was intending to make this huge change in state emergency power that on appellant's account it was doing. But what the legislature did say was that it wanted, when we read the statute, it wanted it to be liberally construed to effectuate its purposes. And so we were told that the purpose of the statute is to address disasters of, in the legislature's words, unprecedented scale, or unprecedented from the statute. And then we're also told to read the text liberally, not narrowly. So I think that when you take those principles and apply them to the text of 127A-14D, there's a clear understanding there that this was intended to be read broadly, not narrowly.
So in a situation like this, and you have to recognize this has gone on for a long time, and we're up to I don't know how many proclamations, but we've got quite a few in a row now. I mean, what is there any bottom to the threshold of what continues to be an emergency? Is it hospitalizations? I mean, and I know it's the governor's a judge, but how does the citizenry assess that and say, hey, now's the time to jump in? I mean, assuming I agree with your reading of the statute, that it's not one and done. I mean.
Well, I think that raises a really important issue because it ultimately comes down to the governor's judgment, but also the range of advice that he receives from, for example, and I think in particular, the Department of Health and others. You know, there's a lot of expertise available to the governor that can help to inform the determination of whether a state of emergency is warranted.
And right, but how, okay, so I hear you, but not everybody trusts the experts, I guarantee you that. But still there has to be some, and I think one of the things that's in the briefs and your brief had 83 footnotes. It was a lot, but we did read them about the basis for the governor's proclamations. But I think if you read the complaint, and I'm sure you have, there is people have been hurt by this too. And it seems, you know, that there ought to be a way for redress at some point if it just keeps going. I mean, what if COVID never goes away? Does that mean we forever live under emergency proclamations?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think one of the most important checks that exists is the legislature can amend Chapter 127A at any point. We certainly concede that. So if the legislature wanted to pass a new section to 127A that says, and there will be no more states of emergency related to COVID-19, they could certainly pass that, and it would be you know, that is something that people, you know, could certainly make All right. themselves heard, and that's an important check. But I want to emphasize, you know, to turn back to the questions we had about legislative history, that the legislature not only hasn't done that, but actually has, in some ways, has ratified the interpretation of 127A that our side is advancing here. So I think Judge McCullen mentioned earlier about the foreclosure, the eviction moratorium bill. I think that's a good example of something that is kind of assumes the continued existence of these emergency powers and builds off that. And there's actually an even more express acknowledgement, I think, and it appears in Act 185, which was enacted last year in June 2021. So this is almost a year after, according to appellants, the state of emergency couldn't have existed. But in Act 185, the legislature made a number of findings, and I think they're really important because they underscore how the legislature is continuing to think about these issues. So if I may, I'll just read briefly from these findings. It says, the legislature finds that COVID-19 has created great challenges to global health, the economy, and way of life, and that the governor and county mayors have had to exercise their emergency powers under Chapter 127A to impose rules aimed to control the spread of COVID-19. And the legislature went on to find that the enforcement of these rules.
I thank you for that, but I'm gonna circle you back to where I circled Mr. Victor, which this is not an appeal that really goes to the substantive merit of the governor's proclamations. This is an appeal from a motion to dismiss that was granted, and your motion said they failed to state a claim on which relief can be granted. Now on count one, I think we're all on the same page here. It really depends on how this court interprets 127A, but maybe you could, you know, you can finish, but please do get to count two because I think the mootness issue and the exceptions to the mootness issue are, you know, that's something you need to address for us today, please.
Absolutely, I appreciate that. And I would just commend Act 185 to the court. The court can read that, of course. So I think with respect to count two, I mean, I think it's important to emphasize that in some ways, responding to the allegations of the appellants has been challenging because it's been a moving target. You know, if we look at the operative complaint, it asserts a void for vagueness challenge, and it doesn't assert, as we mentioned, a separation of powers claim. So I think, you know, they could file a new lawsuit, or, you know, they could seek leave to amend potentially in the circuit court on remand if there were a remand, or they could just file a new lawsuit to assert these separate issues related to separation of powers. But I think, you know, our arguments initially with respect to mootness were made in response to their arguments that particular provisions of emergency proclamations were void for vagueness, right? So it includes allegations that things like the inter-island travel restrictions were vague, that it was difficult to understand different states, different emergency proclamations as they had been worded at the time. And so, you know, we saw this void for vagueness challenge as really being a challenge to particular language that had been used in particular EPs that no longer exist and relate to restrictions that are no longer in place. And so it was our view that is moot with respect to, you know, it's no longer in force, you know, for one thing. And then with respect to capable of repetition, you know, it was our position that, you know, they have a burden of coming forward to say, you know, that there's some likelihood that these restrictions are going to be enforced again. And with respect to, you know, restrictions about beach closures or, you know, wearing masks on the beach, it's not clear that certain aspects of how these EPs were enforced early in the pandemic, that it's likely that will reoccur in future.
But don't you think the public interest exception might apply as well?
I think that, you know, I can see that there is a potential argument with respect to the public interest exception. Unless I've missed it, I don't believe that exception was advanced by appellants. But I mean, I think that's a close question, Your Honor, with respect to the public interest exception. And ultimately, it's a matter for the court's discretion.
But Mr. McLean, you do agree that you argued mootness to the circuit court, because I see you were on the transcript, you're the guy that did it, and you said, so with respect to the vagueness challenge, we think these threshold questions of standing and mootness fully dispose of that claim, and the circuit court took you up on it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, okay, so because that's what's in the order. So part of my question to you, and I was trying to pose it to Mr. Victor, so if we reach that issue and conclude that mootness does not apply here, what's next? What are you saying? What would your recommendation or request be to this court? And what do you think happens from here?
Well, I think the court would have a couple of different options. I think with respect to the vagueness claim, that's not an issue that is briefed before this court. And so it's our position that if the court concludes that the void for vagueness claim was not moot, but was, it's not clear to me that falls within the scope of the appeal. I'm not sure it's one of their—
Right, because the court didn't reach the merits, right? Judge Watanabe concluded that it was moot. She said, as to and this is pretty much a quote, plaintiff's claim in regards to the vagueness of prior emergency proclamations, which are no longer in effect, is deemed moot and is dismissed with prejudice. So wouldn't we have to vacate at least that part of the ruling and remand it to the circuit court?
I think that the court certainly could. I think if the court concluded that it wasn't moot, then that would be the appropriate course of action rather than deciding it on the current record. Yes, Your Honor. So I think one point of clarification that I do want to mention as well, you know, we talked, I think previously before the circuit court about the issue of standing. And I think, you know, with the standing issue, I think it's important to emphasize that when we talk about standing, it kind of encompasses multiple different facets. So there's the issue of whether there's a private right of action, which I think in the past, sometimes courts conflate that with standing under the Declaratory Judgment Act. And then there's also the separate issue of standing under the DCA 632-1. Now, you know, given some intervening case law, I think we're willing to concede at this point that there is standing under the Declaratory Judgment Act. So under the particular factors that the court looks at, you know, we think intervening case law, in particular, the League of Women Voters decision a few months ago, likely does establish that the defendants have Declaratory Judgment Act standing, but it doesn't establish that they have a private right of action under Chapter 127A. So I think with that, just wanted to make that point of clarification.
I appreciate that. And I'm not, I studied that part of your memorandum in support of your motion to dismiss, and it seemed to me, based both on what you put in writing and what you argued before Judge Watanabe, your standing argument stemmed from your mootness argument.
I think that's right. I think to some extent they are they're allied concepts here. But if it's helpful, you know, we're happy to make that clarification on appeal.
Thank you.
So I think that it's important. You know, we heard a little bit about the Wisconsin case, the Fabic v. Evers, and I just want to briefly, you know, we I think address that in our brief. But I do want to emphasize that, you know, the text of that statute is really quite different from what we have here. And in the Wisconsin statute, there's particular language that says a state of emergency will not exceed a certain number of days unless the state of emergency is extended by joint resolution of the legislature. So in the Wisconsin statute, you had not only a time limitation, but a specific discussion by the legislature of what happens after that. And so it refers to, okay, well, the next step after the 60 days is you go back to the legislature and you ask them for an extension. That language does not appear anywhere in the Hawaii framework. There's nothing that even by implication would suggest that the sole method of getting an extension of a state of emergency is through a concurrent resolution by the legislature. So we think the text is dispositive.
Okay, but you explained to me earlier, we're not talking about extensions. Each proclamation stands on its own, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. Okay. And so I think it makes a significant difference here. So I think that is dispositive there. So I think if Your Honor has any questions about the statutory issue, I mean, I'm prepared to speak about the constitutional issue, but it sounds like the court's questions are primarily on the statutory front. So I won't.
I have a question. Is there a point at which the state of emergency kind of turn into a new normal where it should be addressed through legislation as opposed to proclamation?
I think that's certainly a fair point. And I do think it's important to emphasize that the states of emergency are temporary. It is no one's intention to maintain a perpetual state of emergency. And everyone in state government would like very much to get back to a regular order across the board in state government. And everyone understands that states of emergency are the exception, not the rule. So I think that is, you know, right off the top, I think that's a really important point to emphasize. And we conceded in our brief that it's our position that as soon as the conditions make it appropriate and warrant the discontinuing states of emergency, that is very much everyone's intention to discontinue the use of emergency proclamations. And so I think that certainly it's well understood that this is the exception, not the rule. I think with respect to, we spoke earlier, I think, on the question of, well, what are the limitations on in terms of how long these are extended? And I think the issue of, well, if it was issued in bad faith, if it was issued without a rational basis, I think those are important checks. And so those are the kinds of checks that prevent a state of emergency or a series of state of emergencies from continuing so long that they become a new normal, as you say.
Well, and does that get us into the constitutional issue, Mr. McLean? That I don't know that anyone wants to get there, but at some point, if the emergency doesn't look like an emergency anymore, what is the trigger for analyze? And I'm not saying that this complaint has alleged it or hasn't alleged it. I'm just saying, trying to understand, you know, whether it's the delegation issue or, you know, however you frame it, when, you know, other than the good faith of the governor, when, which no one here doubts, I don't believe, not Mr. Victor, not this court, but when is the emergency not an emergency anymore? When is it, this is the normal, we've got, you know, this in the community.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, I think that those are, I think.
Excuse me, please put your mask on.
I think to some extent, those issues are a political issue for the governor and the legislature as well. But I think that it is as you say, I mean, it's a judgment call for the governor, but it's a judgment call that reflects the existing legal framework that we have, and that also can take into account our understanding of the changing science and the changing advice that the government receives. And that's not only from the state government, also from advice from the federal government and from the scientific community and the medical community. So it is certainly, I think it's a complex issue. In some respects, it's a political question, but it is certainly an important issue, and I can say it's an issue that is front and center the mind of all the key decision makers. And I think, unless Your Honors have any other questions, we'll prepare to stand on our briefs.
Anything for the state?
Yeah, I have a quick question. So Mr. Victor brought up a distinction between whichever occurs first versus whichever occurs later. Is that a critical distinction, first or later?
Well, we don't agree that that is a meaningful distinction. And so we think that there are two, in terms of the text of 127A-14D, there are two paths to conclude that additional emergency proclamations are permitted. So the first is the reality that each emergency proclamation is a separate proclamation issued under section 14A. I think that's the first argument, and we've sort of been focusing on that a little bit more today. But there's also a second argument, which is that there is a specific, as we say, a reference to a separate proclamation, and the concept of whichever comes first, as we read that, it simply means that you have 60 days, but if you have a separate proclamation that occurs before 60 days, well, then you can restart the 60-day clock with a new separate proclamation under section 14D. So both of those would be ways to, they're two different paths.
But doesn't it say, aren't we talking about shall terminate ... by a separate proclamation? I mean, doesn't that really, if you read that with all the words and not skip the by part, isn't that section really about how it terminates?
Well, I think it is how it terminates, but it's our position that the way it terminates is by the issuance of a separate proclamation that also restarts the 60-day period. So unless Your Honors have any other questions.
No, I think we're good. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Victor.
Thank you. The reason we're all struggling here is because their construction makes no sense. Your question, does the legislature get involved? Yes, at 60 days. That's what the statute says. And Judge, your point, at what point is an emergency not an emergency, and who decides this? If the governor, in his sole discretion, gets to continue to decide, then that's the answer. Whenever the governor decides to relinquish power, the governor decides to relinquish power, and there is no other way to end this. The reason we're unsatisfied with that answer is because their construction makes no sense. It doesn't make sense to let the governor continually, in his sole discretion, to continue to declare another state of emergency on exactly the same facts. Otherwise, what point does it make to say 60 days it terminates? So the governor, I mean, he said in his response, well, we deliberate, we determine, they might do that, but at the end of the day, the governor in his sole discretion makes the decision. There's only two possibilities here. Either A, our construction, 60 days means 60 days, shall terminate means shall terminate. It doesn't mean the emergency's over. It means the legislature gets involved. They decide when the emergency is over, not the governor in his sole discretion. That construction overthrows everything about this statute. And I really would implore you, please read the case in Wisconsin. That language is weaker than our language because it says, yes, it terminates in 60 days unless the legislature does something to continue it. Ours doesn't even say that. Other than that, they're identical. The issue in that case wasn't that question. The issue in that case was, does the same question here, does the governor get to continue to declare another state of emergency on the same or very substantially similar facts? They said in that case, you can't just change the whereas clause and say, okay, now we have this issue that's different or this issue that's different, just declare another emergency until whenever the governor says, trust me, now, I'll decide for everybody when we're out of a state of emergency in this huge delegation of tremendous powers, which includes seizing this courthouse, which he hasn't done, thankfully. Those kinds of powers, one man decides when that ends, that makes absolutely no sense. And it overthrows everything the legislature very clearly said in that statute. And I don't have enough time to go through it all, but the logic of that Wisconsin case, it wasn't razor thin. It's not different than our statute. The only difference in there at all is the legislature gets to extend it. Okay, the same is implied here. The legislature can certainly come in and say, you know what? Corona is a serious thing. It's going on for a long time. We're going to give you another 60 days or another 6 months or another 2 years. They are the voice of the people. They are the ones who should be making the decision. That's how America works. We don't vest power in one person unless it's a real emergency. And then they get 60 days and then it shall terminate at that point. There is no other reading of this statute that makes any sense whatsoever. The statute is clear. I'd ask you to read it and think about what on earth the legislature, why would they give such dramatic, expansive powers to one man and then just simply let him to continually redeclare? So he, in his sole discretion, in 60 days can decide whether to reallege it? It just makes no sense. It makes sense to give it to the voice of the people. Let them decide if the emergency continues or not. They're the ones who are the voice of the people. That's the only reading here that makes sense. The exact logic applies in that Wisconsin decision. And I hope you read it because that's exactly our argument here. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Eku iluna. Wa ho'oku'u ia mai nei ka aha. Court is now adjourned.